Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello and welcome to this FedSoc Forum webinar call. Today, January 23rd, 2025, we're delighted to host a Courthouse Steps oral argument program on Barnes versus Felix, which was heard by the court yesterday. My name is Kayla Kleist, and I'm an Associate Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's program, as the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. Now, in the interest of time, I will keep my introduction of our guest today brief, but if you'd like to know more, you can check out his impressive full bio at fedsoc.org. Today, we're fortunate to have with us Matthew Cavadon, who's the Robert Poole Fellow in Law and Religion at Emory University School of Law. Before entering that role, he served for nearly 4 years as public defender in Northeast Georgia, representing clients in misdemeanor, felony, and juvenile cases. Well, and I'll leave it there. A last note before we kick off a time of opening remarks. If you have questions throughout the program, please do submit those via the question and answer feature, likely found at the bottom of your Zoom screen, so it'll be accessible when we get to that extended portion of today's webinar. With that, thank you all for joining us today. Mr. Cavadon, the floor is yours.
Okay, thank you very much, Kayla, and it's a pleasure to be here with you all today. I should add, because it's a little bit pertinent to today's conversation, I was one of three co-authors of the Cato Institute's amicus brief in this case, Barnes v. Felix, both at the cert stage and now again at the merits. So this is a case that I've looked at in a fair amount of detail. I do want to shout out Michael Fox and Clark Neely at the Cato Institute, who are my co-authors on that. So the facts of Barnes v. Felix are that a few years back, Ashton Barnes was driving on the Sam Houston Expressway around the city of Houston in a rental car that his girlfriend had taken out. That vehicle had unpaid toll tickets on it. So Mr. Barnes was pulled over based on a camera detecting that he was driving with unpaid tickets. A member of the Harris County, Texas Constable's Office was the one who pulled over Mr. Barnes. He approached the vehicle, started asking questions. We have limited detail as to the nature of their conversation, because although there was a dash cam in the constable's car, he did not have a body cam on. What we can see from the video is that at some point during their conversation, the turn signal on Mr. Barnes's vehicle turns back on. Constable Felix orders him to stop. The vehicle then begins to pull forward slowly. At that point, Constable Felix steps onto the runner of the car, draws his service weapon, and fires multiple shots into the passenger compartment of the car. He kills Mr. Barnes almost immediately. Mr. Barnes's survivors, his family, brought a federal civil rights suit in United States District Court. The United States District Court held that there was no Fourth Amendment violation, applying the Fifth Circuit's moment of threat doctrine test. What the district court said was it was not allowed to consider issues like the nature of the stop, what other options Officer Felix had before stepping onto the vehicle, or any of those things, but rather that under the Fifth Circuit precedent, the judge was bound to consider only whether or not Officer Felix was facing a threat at the moment that he pulled the trigger. Because he was standing on the side of a moving vehicle, Officer Felix was in danger at that point. That was all that was relevant to assessing the use of force by Officer Felix. This case then went up on appeal to the Fifth Circuit, where a panel of three judges heard the case. That panel unanimously agreed that the moment of threat doctrine is what the Fifth Circuit's test is, and that looking again only at that 2 second snippet of time, Officer Felix was in danger, therefore deadly force was authorized. However, the author of the panel's opinion, Judge Higginbotham, wrote his own separate concurrence. He said that he had serious concerns that the Fifth Circuit was misapplying U.S. Supreme Court precedent, that this moment of threat test, in fact, requires courts to exclude a lot of information that's relevant to considering whether or not a search or a seizure is constitutionally reasonable. He looked at common law and at U.S. Supreme Court precedent and said there's nothing requiring a circuit court or a trial court to only look at the moment of threat Rather, there's supposed to be a more holistic analysis. Mr. Barnes's survivors petitioned the United States Supreme Court to review the case and consider this issue of the moment of threat doctrine. The court did grant certiorari and asked the question of whether or not there's a moment of threat doctrine within its own precedent or within the Fourth Amendment. Yesterday, the case was argued. And by the way, I should note there's a circuit split on the moment of threat test. There are about four federal appellate courts that apply it. A number do not. Some other courts say that they apply it, but then look at officer activity further up the chain. Some other courts say that they don't apply it, but put a lot of emphasis on whether or not an officer contributed to the danger that the officer then used as justification for using force. So there might be a two-way split. There might be a three-way split. That's something that the United States's attorney pointed out at oral argument yesterday. To take a quick look backward before we get to the U.S. Supreme Court, the brief that I co-authored for the Cato Institute took a deep dive into the common law, looking at Blackstone, looking at 1800s United States precedent, and found that the moment of threat doctrine really did not exist. There was a rule that any fleeing accused felon could be met with deadly force, could be killed during flight. That's a rule that the Supreme Court got rid of in the 1970s, saying that the definition of felon had moved so much over the centuries that that no longer made sense as a dividing line. Nowadays, the Supreme Court says that a court has to look at whether an officer was protecting other people from imminent harm, what the nature was of the offense that the person was fleeing from, so on and so forth. They cannot shoot somebody simply because they're a fleeing felon. Outside of that rule, though, the common law required courts to look carefully at the nature of the offense that a person was fleeing from when they were struck down by law enforcement or by constables or justices of the peace, as well as the threat that they posed to others, whether or not they were armed, all those kinds of things. There was what we would call nowadays a totality of the circumstances analysis. So yesterday at oral argument, there were actually four different presentations. That is quite a bit more than most U.S. Supreme Court cases get. The United States weighed in on the side of Mr. Barnes's survivors and said that the moment of threat doctrine is too broad. The state of Texas weighed in on behalf of Constable Felix and said that officers should not be held liable based on things that they do at some remove from their actual use of force. In spite of there being four different presentations, there was some agreement. All four parties agreed that there should not be any test requiring courts to look only at the very split second surrounding a use of force. Mr. Barnes in the United States argued strongly for a totality of the circumstances test, like the one used at common law, which is to consider the whole scheme of how an arrest unfolded, what the nature of the offense at issue is, the risk to the public, so on and so forth. The state of Texas and Constable Felix's attorney actually pivoted quite a bit at oral argument yesterday. They argued that the party's only dispute was about whether or not officers can be held liable if they created danger earlier in the encounter. That is a somewhat separate issue. There have been some cases in federal courts and elsewhere that have looked at whether an officer was properly trained, whether or not subjectively they were acting in good faith when they, say, decided not to knock on a door before entering, things like that. Certain courts have said that if an officer created danger at some point during the encounter, then they are liable for using force later on, even if it's ultimately the suspect who uses force first. The state of Texas and Constable Felix's attorney argued that that exposes officers to too much liability. A number of the justices, though, pointed out that didn't sound like the nature of the dispute based on the earlier briefing in the case. The Fifth Circuit's opinion in this case said that we would like to be able to consider more information here, but we're not allowed to based on our own precedent. Judge Higginbotham said. Fifth Circuit precedent says we only look at these 2 seconds, and that's all that's relevant. The district court also said, I would like to consider more here, but I am constrained from doing so. Yesterday, though, Constable Felix's attorney and the state of Texas's attorney said that that's actually not an accurate understanding of Fifth Circuit precedent. That other Fifth Circuit cases have made it clear that courts can consider other facts, and that all that the Fifth Circuit meant in its opinion below was that it wasn't going to apply this officer-created danger doctrine. That came as a surprise to a number of the justices, several of whom pointed out that they granted cert in order to answer the question of whether or not there's a use of a moment of threat doctrine. A couple of justices said, look, given that it appears that all 4 parties here agree that there is no such doctrine, why don't we just write a narrow opinion and send this back down and let the case proceed accordingly? I think, and this is me reading into it a little bit, I think Constable Felix's attorney and the state of Texas's attorney were satisfied that they won below, that there was no Fourth Amendment violation. I think that they found that there were difficulties with defending the rule that the Fifth Circuit used here on appeal because it is made up, but that they didn't want to lose the verdict. And so by arguing that, in fact, the Fifth Circuit, if you squinted really hard, was doing something else, was their way of trying to defend the verdict that they had. In any event, some of the issues that came up during argument and that the justices seemed concerned about were how narrow the opinion should be. One very narrow option would simply be to say, there is no moment of threat doctrine. Apply the test that a number of other circuits use, get rid of that step, broaden out the view for the court, take off the blinders, look at the totality of the circumstances, and let juries and judges make their usual calls about what's reasonable, about when force is justified, about what sort of causation leads to tragedies if they should unfold. A couple of other justices, though, Justice Kavanaugh, Justice Alito, Justice Thomas, expressed some interest in providing guidance for officers as well. There was reference made to the awful attack earlier this month in New Orleans involving a vehicle. A couple of the justices said you might be stopping somebody for, say, unpaid toll fees, but how do you know if they're about to commit a terror attack or to drive out and try to use their vehicle as a deadly weapon against other people? What about circumstances where somebody abducted might be inside the vehicle and the driver starts to head off? Now, on the one hand, the attorney for the United States and the attorney for Mr. Barnes's family both said that the severity of the charge and the possibility of risk posed to the public are relevant, that we want police officers to use deadly force to stop terrorist attacks. We believe that it's justified for them to use serious force to stop an abduction that's going on in progress. Nevertheless, an officer doesn't know always whether or not a person that they're stopping for a traffic offense is potentially a very dangerous person. I didn't hear the phrase presumption of innocence come up yesterday, but it was in my head as I was listening to some of their questions. We can't have a rule that presumes that every driver is 2 steps away from committing a terror attack. There have to be some presumptions of innocence and regularity and undergirding how we assess police use force. Another question was, the state of Texas asked the justices to include language in the opinion saying that it is rare for the use of force to be non-justified in a situation where somebody is driving away from a traffic stop. I believe it was Justice Barrett said that might be putting a thumb on the scales here. Every case just has to be assessed on its own. And the Supreme Court shouldn't inject stray comments into its opinion that then every party and every judge is going to cite to say, well, this is not the extremely rare case where, say, you can win against police officers who used force. So that appears to be the main question at this point in the game, not a substantive question about the law, but rather a question about how broad the opinion is going to be, whether or not the court is careful to avoid stray comments in writing the opinion, so on and so forth. thinking about broader implications of Barnes and whatever decision may come down, one is the issue of minor traffic enforcement. One of the big conversations over the last 5-10 years has been whether or not armed police officers are the best way of doing minor traffic enforcement. Houston itself and the Sam Houston Expressway uses automated cameras to pick up on unpaid tolls and things like that. That's in fact how Mr. Barnes got stopped in the first place. Does there need to be a blue light pulling somebody over in that circumstance? Or does the possible risk of violence mean that sending somebody a citation in the mail, or if there is a stop and the person pulls away, radioing ahead and having somebody intercept them later on is more reasonable than trying to use deadly force right there in the spot? Another big question outside the traffic context is Second Amendment cases. There have been a number of cases of police officers going to execute search warrants or arrest warrants, sometimes at the wrong addresses. And if the person inside meets them with even a legally held firearm, sometimes that can result in a firefight. There are concerns that the moment of threat doctrine means that officers can go in, do a no-knock warrant, maybe even be in plain clothes, maybe even be at the wrong address, intrude on an American gun owner, kill the gun owner, and then be immune from liability as a result. So this is an issue that has raised concerns with gun rights advocates as well, that too much immunity here or too narrow a scope of liability could pose a threat to Americans exercising their right to keep and bear arms. Another issue, and certainly one that the justices were sensitive to yesterday, is how much is the court going to wade into difficult factual issues? Judge Don Willett on the Fifth Circuit recently said that he and his colleagues shouldn't play junior varsity jury, but rather should trust that trial courts, judges, and juries are in the best position to make close judgment calls about the reasonableness of force. That's obviously not always the case. There are legal issues, but maybe a case like Barnes v. Felix around how much time did Constable Felix have to decide whether to step onto the runner, what other options might he have had, how quickly was traffic moving that Mr. Barnes might have pulled out into. Those are just not the kinds of questions that the U.S. Supreme Court is very well primed to answer. And then last but not least, we got a clear indication that the court is wrestling with this issue of officer-created danger. Like I mentioned earlier, some courts have held that if an officer creates danger at some point up the chain of events, maybe even at the planning stage, then they may be liable for anything that happens as a result. Other courts have said it can be relevant that an officer contributed to the harm. Other courts have said it's got to be a purely objective consideration. It's based only on what unfolds. There are difficult factual issues that come up here. Texas and Constable Felix's attorney clearly wanted the case yesterday to be about that issue. I don't think the Supreme Court has the appetite to resolve those tough issues unnecessarily. So I don't think that this is going to be the opinion that resolves some of the tricky issues in that area. That said, it is clear the justices have been thinking about this issue. It is on their radar. I expect that there will be a case in the next couple of years where the court does decide to wade in and try to sort through when officers are liable for strategic decisions that they make, even outside the immediate tactical setting, or tactical decisions that are one or two steps up the road from the force that actually unfolded. So that's my introduction. I'm glad to have some further discussion or take questions and answers.
Thank you so much for that summary of the case and the facts, and as well as how we got here and a little bit of oral argument. I will issue a reminder to our audience that if you do have questions, you can submit those via the Q&A feature. And as those start to come in, I'd love to pose one or two of my own to kick things off. Before we get into oral argument and how it went, I'd love to clarify a little bit of this moment of threat doctrine, partially because it was a question in oral argument. Is this new? And if not, whence does it derive?
No, is the short answer to that. Texas and Constable Felix's attorneys both argued yesterday that Judge Higginbotham made up a straw man and then struck it down in his separate concurrence, that no court in the country looks only at the moment of threat in assessing the reasonableness of use of force. That's not correct. The moment of threat doctrine is a term that I've been familiar with for several years at this point. It does come up. And again, the trial judge here, the judge who wrote the majority opinion here, both said that they were bound, in spite of their better angels here, to look only at the moment of threat. So Texas and Constable Felix wanted the test to be only whether or not the officer created danger and whether or not that automatically creates liability. That is not what this case was briefed on. That's not what the cert petition was about. I know that because I worked on this case at the certiorari stage, again, in an amicus capacity. And that's not the question that the Supreme Court granted cert on. Now, a grant of cert does not necessarily mean that the Supreme Court has done its own investigation into an issue. But let's get real. If the United States Supreme Court grants cert on a question, I guarantee you that clerks and judges have looked into whether or not this thing exists. If it didn't, if this was truly just made up, then the court would have either dismissed the case as improvidently granted or done what's called a GVR, a grant, vacate, remand, basically just saying real quick, here's two citations, you applied the wrong law, hop back to it. That's not the case here. As far as why the moment of threat doctrine exists, it exists for a lot of reasons that qualified immunity and other doctrines exist, which is concern about ensuring that police officers can do their jobs without undue scrutiny. That's a fair concern. Nobody here wants police officers to be afraid that some pencil pusher down the road is going to micro assess their work and slap them with major liability accordingly. That said, this goes quite a bit to the other extreme. This takes natural understanding that some decisions are split-second decisions and uses that to ignore how we got to those split seconds in the first place. Sometimes that's because a suspect steps out of line and does something dangerous. Other times it's because an officer behaves overzealously. Those are the kinds of tough calls that should be sifted through by courts, by judges, by juries, and that's not what happens under the moment of threat doctrine, where we just pretend that nothing happened until all of a sudden force happened. And if it was justified, it was justified.
Got it. Continuing on the conversation of how the respondents chose to frame the argument they were making, is the totality of circumstances doctrine separate from officer-created threat? Or is officer-created threat a subsection of that? Do we have a clear sort of like, here's how the two interact with each other? Obviously, it's an ongoing conversation in the space.
That depends on how courts interpret this officer-created danger doctrine. Certain ones will simply say something that makes common sense, which is if an officer unprovokedly creates a dangerous situation and then uses that as an excuse to shoot somebody, then they can be liable for that. In fact, Texas's attorney and Constable Felix's attorney yesterday agreed that an officer may, of course, be responsible for creating a dangerous situation. Nobody disagrees with that. The question is, again, how attenuated do we get? Do we go back to, well, the police department didn't train people on all of the possible de-escalation techniques. And if they did, they didn't bring in quite good enough mental health experts. And if they did, well, then maybe this officer would have responded in a way that didn't create the danger in the first place. So we're going to get into, now again, that's kind of a straw man in itself. I don't know that any court would be that picky about what happened. But there's a spectrum, right, between here's the 2 seconds that matter versus here's a 20-year pattern at the department that matters and how officers create danger. Somewhere in between is totality of the circumstances, I think, which is to look at how did everything unfold within traditional legal concepts of proximate causation and nearness to the event that we're talking about here. And then what is it that caused things to go badly? If an officer's unreasonable execution of a seizure or of a search contributed to that, and there should be constitutional liability for that. And if not, and if it was from the suspect, then officers should not be liable. So.
Got it. We have an audience question about the potential ramifications of this case, in particular what it may mean for officers. I know there was some discussion of that in oral argument as well. Can you give flesh out a little bit of what this might mean? And then you can say, hey, here's how, if the decision goes this way, here's what it might mean for training of officers, what officers may need to think about in stops and what prudence looks like.
Sure. So I see the question suggests that officers would do well to knock and identify themselves before entering a home, because a lot of Americans are armed. And so that could be a dangerous situation if officers don't make clear who they are and what they're doing somewhere. To give an example from some decades ago, there was a U.S. Supreme Court case in the 1950s where police officers were investigating a possible illegal lottery or bingo at a boarding house. They decided to have plainclothes officers jimmy open a window inside the house, sneak inside, and search for evidence. The U.S. Supreme Court held that this was not appropriate, that there needed to be some kind of a warrant and some kind of judicial scrutiny about this. Justice Robert Jackson wrote an opinion concurring, saying, look, this isn't just a matter of technical legality. This is a matter of safety, because a lot of women finding somebody jimmying open the window inside of a bedroom, especially at nighttime, might pull out a gun. He said at that point, one of two things might happen. One is the woman shoots the officer, and that is a dangerous thing. The other possibility is the officer shoots the woman. And Jackson said, if that happened under these circumstances, I would have a hard time convincing a jury that it wasn't murder by the officer. So there is awareness here that these rules are meant to protect life. That is part of the reason why there are really tight restrictions on no-knock warrants. That's something that got a lot of attention in the United States over the past decade. I'm sure listeners will remember the Breonna Taylor incident, where officers executed a no-knock warrant on an apartment. Turns out the suspect no longer lived there. His ex did, with her new boyfriend. They did have guns. After firing a shot at what they thought were home intruders, officers killed Breonna. So no-knock warrants are dangerous. Police identifying themselves is really important. And yes, I do think that if the court here holds that there is no moment of threat doctrine, but that the totality of the circumstances matters, then I would hope that departments and officers get the message that they need to think about how serious is the offense here. Is this the kind of thing that we need to kill somebody in order to prevent other harm? Or is this, say, unpaid traffic tickets and we'll get them next time around or send something to their door? Officers should also consider what other alternatives they have and whether or not there's a threat to the public. Again, if this is an abduction case and this is a matter of saving a child or not, then yes, by all means, use whatever force is necessary. But a lot of other traffic stops, stops on the street, are for much less serious offenses. And that is something that courts should consider when they ask whether or not deadly force was reasonable.
Got it. Moving a little into oral argument, you mentioned the question that is before the court, which is concerning whether or not this particular test was appropriate. We got a lot of conversation about what might happen upon remand and the arguments that could be made there and analyzing the facts. Is that normal when you sort of have this change in the argumentation? And what might that mean for the opinion that we eventually get?
As far as how normal it is, I don't know. I think all of the justices are more than aware that a remand, especially with a narrow opinion, just means that the trial court here ultimately is going to get this case back and is going to have to do what trial courts do day in and day out, which is look at a whole bunch of facts, figure out where there are or are not disputes, and resolve them. Now, lurking in the context of all of this, this case has not yet litigated the issue of qualified immunity. which is whether or not Constable Felix would have been on fair notice of any rights violation. The law in this area is somewhat unclear, clearly. I am positive that when this goes back, Constable Felix is going to raise qualified immunity and say that even if there was a rights violation here, it wasn't clearly established enough for him to be held liable. If not, one of the questions that came up during argument yesterday was, it's the question that always comes up in civil rights cases. Is it fair to have people win money awards against police officers? Does that threaten police officers from being able to do their jobs appropriately and protecting the public? The factual reality is police officers virtually never pay these judgments out of pocket. Empirical studies have shown that upwards of 95, 98% of all the money paid out for federal civil rights violations comes from insurance policies. Governments are insured. Law enforcement agencies are insured. Police unions are insured. There are organizations with deep pockets that end up paying these. Now, on the one hand, that's probably a good thing for society as a whole in that we don't want officers to be bankrupt for making tough calls. On the other hand, it could interfere with the ability to reform tough policing tactics in that if officers aren't feeling the crunch, are they going to respond? That's where administrators have a really important role. That's where insurance companies and police departments and decision makers need to help to push for accountability. And that's actually something that we saw with the spread of body cameras. A number of legislatures stepped in and required departments to start having body cameras, but so did a lot of insurance companies. Insurance companies also had a role in cutting down on chokeholds and other issues. So I know that that goes a little bit beyond just what happens on remand toward what happens more structurally with a case like this. But I think those issues are going to come up. An insurance company might have a role in telling a government, look, we're not going to be on the hook for, say, killings of people who are trying to walk away from spitting gum on the ground or something along those lines.
Got it. Well, I'd love to get to the potential ramifications of this case in a moment, but I do have a last question on oral argument, barring any from our audience. We've talked a little bit about the surprising change in the argumentation before the court. Was there any arguments that you were surprised not to see raised in the OA from either side or from any of the four, I guess?
Given that there is a circuit split and a number of different federal courts have held that the moment of threat doctrine makes sense, that it aligns with the policy objectives of Section 1983 and federal civil rights law, that it's compatible with the Fourth Amendment, I was surprised not to hear any defense of it. I could have understood if either Constable Felix or Texas had decided not to defend that rule, and fair enough. But I was surprised to hear, especially this late in the game, this late in the litigation, after this many rounds of briefing, after the cert question was granted, that all of a sudden this became a nothing burger. Where's the beef? We thought that we were all here. A couple of the justices noted we granted cert on one question. We kind of figured we'd be talking about that today, and instead we're just not. So I was surprised not to hear a defense of it. I criticized the moment of threat doctrine in the two amicus briefs that I co-authored, but I don't think it's not the craziest argument that's been before the Supreme Court recently. I mean, certainly folks could have raised it and just didn't. So I was surprised to hear that kind of unanimity. I do think that simplifies the job for the court on this case, but I was a little bit surprised not to hear a full-throated defense of it.
Okay. Well, I guess that then opens the door to my next question. Is there any way we get a opinion that embraces the moment of threat doctrine and goes, yeah, this is exactly right. The circuit was absolutely correct here.
I would be mightily surprised, but I'm never going to say never.
Fair enough.
Texas and Constable Felix asked for a very significant reinterpretation and rereading of the opinions below. I don't think none of the justices yesterday expressed any interest in going that route. And a couple expressed the opinion that it was far too much of a stretch. So I don't think that that is going to wind up being the route that the court goes. That said, surprises happen. folks may remember a couple of years ago, there was a separation of powers case where the parties all agreed on one solution. One law professor wrote his own amicus brief and said they're all wrong, a pox on all their houses. And the Supreme Court agreed and said, we agree with this one amicus. So anything is possible. That said, after the arguments that happened yesterday, to have that show up would be, it would be a little bit unanticipated and unanticipable for anybody other than clerks who are currently working on it, I would think, to see the outcome come down in favor of the moment of threat doctrine. I was left yesterday with no awareness of any way that that doctrine is going to continue to hold water.
Okay, fair enough. Well, then turning to more probable outcomes, there's a fair amount of conversation about what reject yes, turn down moment of threat doctrine, and then what? So could you give a little bit of what was asked for by each party and then what seems to be the most potential outcome of we reject the moment of threat doctrine and we do nothing, we get a footnote that you should be really careful about the context you consider, we're fully on board with officer-created threat. What's that potential here?
So lurking behind all of this is, all right, so we say the totality of the circumstances. Well, the totality of what circumstances and what circumstances weigh in which directions? This is a perennial tension in Supreme Court law, which is how much do we want to give clear black-letter guidance, or sorry, black-letter rules, not guidance, right? Which is, you shall knock before you execute a warrant unless it contains specific lines saying that you may not. Or you have 16 days to file Form 234G before you get to litigate this kind of case. Predictability is nice when it is possible. Then, on the flip side of things, we have broad standards that are not bright line rules, but that involve considering what's legally relevant. The Fourth Amendment itself says that Americans are protected against unreasonable searches and seizures. There are some rules in that context, and there's a lot of standards in that context. So I am quite confident that the Supreme Court is not going to want to spell out a whole lot of rules in this context. Justice Scalia thought it was a fool's errand, that the entire purpose of the Fourth Amendment here, especially around use of force, is to invite courts to undergo heavy, extensive inquiry. Because no two fact patterns are ever the same. No two cases are ever the same. You can't say that, you know, raininess and streetlights are always relevant, or hearing toilets flushing that might be flushing drugs is always relevant. Every case has to depend on its own facts. Now, the dissatisfying part about that is it does mean that the Supreme Court can't oftentimes either open the door to broad liability or close it and let police officers go about their jobs without interference. Rather, it means that you do have a lot of litigation. There's a big role for trial courts in digging deep into specific facts, weighing them carefully, sometimes disagreeing about what facts matter and what ones don't and how to do that. Two perfectly qualified federal judges may come to completely different answers. Juries do, and so we leave them locked in a room for a really long time to argue it out until they come up with a unanimous agreement, right? So, or a majority or whatever it may be. So I think what you're going to see in this case is a very general just look, reasonableness and totality of the circumstances are frustrating tests for lawyers in a lot of ways. Nevertheless, they're what the Constitution calls for here, and they're what's required by reality. There's just not a whole lot of strictures that you can put on an inquiry like this. We do know that you can't just zero in on 2 seconds of time, and that's all that's relevant. The parties have to be able to present evidence, call witnesses, get in there and do what lawyers do, which is argue about the significance of different facts.
Got it. Well, assuming that happens, what does that mean both for Barnes and Felix in the immediate and for the broader circuits that have been embracing moment of threat doctrine and now will have to reconsider?
Those are good questions, Kayla. So I think as far as this case specifically goes, the next fight, again, is going to be on qualified immunity. Before we get super deep into the court needing to make factual judgment calls, the parties are going to get all the facts out in the record, and then Constable Felix is almost certainly going to seek qualified immunity to argue that, look, even if there was a violation here, there has not been another case similar enough to say that he should be held liable in this case. Now, whether or not that proves convincing, I haven't looked deeply enough at Fifth Circuit case law around traffic stops to have a strong sense of that. So that's something that the parties are going to fight about. If qualified immunity proves not too attached to this case, then the parties are going to head closer and closer toward trial. There might be a point where a judge says, hey, look, now that we've seen everything, there really aren't any issues left for a jury. Or there might be the point where the judge simply says, yeah, figuring out exactly what was reasonable, what Officer Felix said and thought and saw exactly when under the circumstances, this is just a judge is not any more qualified than any other American to sit down and try to parse that out. And so this is headed to jury trial. I don't know. Settlement is always an option as well. It could be that both sides have just had enough time in the courtroom and there's going to be a settlement. I don't know. Those are all possibilities for this case. Now, as far as thinking ahead to litigation in areas that have had the moment of threat doctrine, in the event the Supreme Court says this doesn't exist, that means that cases relying on it are no longer going to be good law. So fortunately here, there is, again, a pretty broad circuit split, and there are a lot of circuits that do not apply the moment of threat doctrine. That means that there's a good amount of precedent for attorneys in some of those other jurisdictions to draw on as they think about what the world is going to look like here. This isn't the kind of case where we're overturning a U.S. Supreme Court decision after 40 years of doing something some way, and so there's a lot of uncertainty. There will need to be some skills learned, but there are a lot of decisions operating in a world that just doesn't have a moment of threat doctrine. So it's not like we're going back and reinventing the wheel from scratch here. Attorneys should be able to cite precedent from other circuits and rely on that.
Got it. Well, I have a last question, and then barring any from our audience, we may get to wrap early and give everyone a section of their afternoons back. We've given sort of a here's how the case might come out. So I'll press a little bit farther. Do you have a read, even if it's a more general one, of how the court specifically will break out and what the key issues will be? If it's not 9-0, what's going to be dividing the justices?
That's a good question. I think there is a reasonable chance of a 9-0, maybe even a per curiam, which means written by a staff attorney, decision simply saying there's no moment of threat doctrine. Here's like eight cases talking about the totality of the circumstances. Go do that. Super short, 5 to 10 pages tops. Call it a day. Where I think there would be some other commentary and where I could see concurrences in the judgment, or rather maybe full concurrences, but with some breathing room there, Justice Kavanaugh, Justice Alito, Justice Thomas, all I think do have interest in signaling that police officers need a pretty broad scope of protection in order to do their jobs properly. Whether or not that winds up getting pushback from, say, Justice Sotomayor or Justice Jackson coming in and saying, well, but not always. Sometimes the accountability side's important too. I don't know. There might be, given that there are other issues looming around police officers, creation of danger, use of force, the justices may want to get out of this one with as little damage done as possible and just have a quick unanimous opinion and call it a day. Or maybe this will be a chance where they start to preview what that's going to look like and where you start to see more justices chiming in with, you know, this was a super easy case. However, we are aware that coming down the road, there are all these other issues. Do not interpret us as having ruled on this today. But if we did, by golly, we think that officers shouldn't be liable for things that happened back at HQ. Or we think that officers can be liable for systematic issues. Or I don't know. You might see some wrestling and side opinions around that. Again, I did not hear any justice nor any of the attorneys defending the moment of threat doctrine as it was characterized by the challengers here. And I didn't hear any justices taking the invitation of Felix's and Texas's attorneys here to see the Fifth Circuit as having done something totally different than everybody thought it was doing. So I don't think that there's going to be a split on the court in that regard. Then again, the last time that I said there was going to be an I know on anything, it was quite a few years ago, and it wound up being 5-4. So I really don't want to put myself in that kind of a position. I'd like to think I've learned a thing or two since then. Anything is possible. Still, it appears that there's a pretty broad consensus here that the test as it exists now is just wrong.
Well, when all four parties in a case agree, maybe the justices all will too.
Maybe. We'll find out.
Indeed. Well, thank you so much. Really appreciate you spending this afternoon sharing your expertise and insight and having this analysis of this case. I will look forward to hearing what the decision is and whether or not this analysis makes sense after that. Thanks also to our audience for joining and participating. Welcome listener feedback by email at fedsocforums@fedsoc.org. And as always, keep an eye on our website and your emails for announcements about other upcoming virtual events. With that, thank you all for joining us today. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.